This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And today, we're going to have a guest at 11:30, and it's going to be someone who's been on our program before, Dr. Joy Antonelle DeMarchita. Dr. DeMarchita is the medical director of the David and Rhoda Chase Family Movement Disorders Center at Hartford Hospital. She's part of Hartford Healthcare. And, you know, I get a lot of questions from listeners about tremor and shaking. And in the past year, we've had my friend Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez on talking about tremor and the types of tremor. But today we're going to talk with Dr. DeMarchita about a new treatment. Some of you may have seen it on TV. It's something that is unique in this area to the Hartford Hospital and the Chase Family Movement Disorder Center, called high-intensity focused ultrasound. So we're going to chat with her about that in the second half of our program today. This day in medicine, February 8th, 1577, English author Robert Burton was born. Mr. Burton, and he was not a physician, but he wrote a publication called The Anatomy of Melancholy in 1621. And it is considered one of the first psychiatric encyclopedias. He was more of a philosopher, but really translated everything into psychiatric terms. So we remember that as really a very important publication in medicine. We're hearing a lot about the flu. This has been really the worst flu season, more intense in the last 15 years, based on the percentage of doctors' visits that are flu-driven. We're also seeing COVID and RSV, but flu has really dominated even COVID. And what's interesting is we're starting to hear about school closings, particularly in the Midwest. We're hearing about it in Texas. Ohio has been closing many schools for a week at a time. And it's interesting because, you know, people were so critical about closing schools during COVID and how this was affecting things. And now we're hearing about school closings, but I think it's ironic in the fact that these school closings are occurring in states where we have the lowest rate of vaccination. Let's not forget, we have a flu vaccine. We have a COVID vaccine. We have an RSV vaccine. So, you know, people are sacrificing their health because of misinformation about vaccines, especially the flu vaccine. Now, people always say, well, I got the flu anyhow. But the flu, when you get it, if you have been vaccinated, is much less intense. We have measured this. This has been studied in terms of people getting back to work sooner if they have been vaccinated. So vaccines work. There's a lot of talk about we're going to study vaccines. Well, let's look at it. The states where we have higher vaccination rates are not closing schools. That's just one piece of information. So with that, I urge people to get their vaccines when they're due. I certainly do. And check with your physician. Ask if what they think. And I think you'll find that your physician has gone out and gotten vaccinated as well. An interesting study published, and you know, I like to talk a lot about this program, about how we can live longer, right? I think that's our goal, is if you enjoy your life, how do you live longer and be more productive during those years? So the Bloomberg American Health Initiative issued a preliminary report, and they've been studying this for quite a while at Johns Hopkins. And the study was, why are Americans dying sooner than people in the United Kingdom? So the United Kingdom being England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, but particularly they looked at Wales and England. And this was what I found astonishing, that babies born 40 years ago, so that's 1985. So babies born in 1985 had the same life expectancy here in the United States as they did in the United Kingdom. Now, Americans born, children born in this country, now will live 3 years less than children born today in the United Kingdom. Now, these are all industrialized countries. Now, you might say they're smaller, but all the studies were done per capita. So you can look at it that, but here's what's most astounding. All of the reasons for people dying sooner here were preventable. We just haven't prevented them. So let's drill down on them. We talked about this last week with Dr. DeSimone. For you regular listeners, Dr. DeSimone is a cardiovascular surgeon at St. Francis Hospital, and we talked about cardiovascular disease. That's the number one reason. That alone accounted for 57% of that three-year gap. That includes heart disease and stroke, and the risk factors for those things: diabetes, smoking, obesity. So these are preventable factors. So what's the difference between here and the United Kingdom? Well, in the United Kingdom, they have better access to care, and their care is organized around prevention. In this country, we're seeing people who are less active, right? We drive everywhere. So less active in terms of walking and exercise. Our diet is worse than other countries, especially with respect to sodium, which leads to hypertension and eventually cardiovascular disease, and our problems with diabetes and controlling blood sugars in this country. So a lot of this is diet-related, exercise-related, things you've heard on this program all along. That's 57% of the gap. The second one I found interesting, and that is opioid use. Overdoses on opioids counted for 32% of the gap. So that's three times the rate of overdose. We have three times the rate of overdose in the United States versus the United Kingdom. Why? Well, in the United Kingdom, they have more access to addiction care, especially in prisons. When we talk about addiction care, we're talking about the use of Suboxone and other medications that get rid of that desire to remain addicted to opioids. So those drugs are more available in those countries, and systems for controlling that, especially in prisons, because that's where we're seeing this. We just lock people up and house them. We're not going to change anything. And guess what? If you get rid of their addiction, you probably get rid of a lot of crime, right? Because when the addiction is treated, they don't need to rob from you to get money to go out and buy more drugs. So how do you change that? One of the problems in this country is the fact that the prison systems are regulated by different states, different counties. Everybody has a different plan on how they're going to run their prisons. Whereas in the United Kingdom, they are run by a national program from the standpoint of setting criteria and making services available for prisoners. So again, you have to do more than just house criminals. And if you can get them to stop being addicted, it will again change all our life expectancy. The third reason is guns. gun-related homicide and suicide accounted for 20% of the gap. There are 13.3 deaths per 100,000 in the United States due to guns, whereas in the United Kingdom, it's 0.1 deaths per 100,000. Now, there are highly restricted laws on guns and weapons in the United Kingdom, things that we would never get passed here because of the Second Amendment. But we can do a lot better. As a matter of fact, more than half of all the suicides in teens, just in teenagers, are gun-related. So how do you change things and still preserve our Constitution? It's not real hard. We've talked about it here. You start licensing people before they buy a weapon. You have to go get a license. Make it a universal, not state to state, where you could buy it in one state, bring it to another state, and shoot people up. Red flag laws, where weapons are removed from the home when someone is at risk of either causing harm to themselves or others. We need to push those and push for that type of legislation, and we'll see a difference. And the fourth reason are car crashes. This accounted for a 17% gap. In the United States, we are six times the rate of a fatal car crash than in the United Kingdom. Why is that? Well, there are three items. Basically, there's more intelligent speed adaptation is what they call it. Basically, people tend to obey the speed limit more in the United Kingdom. There are advanced technologies for impaired driving. Again, so alcohol being a big reason for people getting into accidents, that technology is available and we need to look at that. And also accident avoidance perceptions. But we need to look at one, and that's impaired driving. You know, driving is not a right, it's a privilege. There are many people, and I know this personally because I have patients out there who should not be operating a motor vehicle and are doing so. And it's not because of age. I don't want people saying, well, just because we're old, okay? Because I'm old. And the question becomes, have you lost your ability, either by illness or some other injury, to operate a motor vehicle? And I think that's the important part. So what are we going to do? We need to do better in terms of coordinating our health policy. You know, we're hearing a lot about government efficiency these days. Well, let's be real. Efficiency doesn't mean just cutting budgets and cutting people's jobs. It's about productivity. Efficiency in any motor or in any system is basically getting the most output, the most productivity, based on the effort you put in. The effort might be money, but it often is the system and how it works. We can have a better system. We spend, by orders of magnitude, more than the United Kingdom on healthcare. And yet, we produce an inferior product. So if people want to focus on efficiency, what they should be looking at is healthcare and how we use even those same healthcare dollars. You don't have to cut the dollars, but look at how you're using those dollars to create a more efficient product. That's the hard part. The easy part is going in and firing people and let's cut the budget. Let's get rid of the budget and we're done. That's easy. Anybody could do that. You don't have to be a Phi Beta Kappa to do that. But to really analyze the system and look at it carefully and make it more efficient, that's the hard part. That's what takes real intellect. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to talk a little bit about peripheral neuropathy and a question I had from James in the past, so I want to touch on that. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And I want to touch on a bigger topic, James had gotten back to me and sent a very nice email talking a little bit about peripheral neuropathy. So since this is my area of expertise and what I practice, I thought we'd touch on some of it today, and we'll kind of have a continuing conversation about it. So the nervous system is divided up into the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. Central nervous system being the brain and spinal cord, and the peripheral nervous system being the nerves as they extend out from the nerve roots in the spine all the way down to our extremities. When you look at a nerve, it consists of two basic structures. There's the axon. So if you think of an electrical wire, the axon would be the inner or copper part of the wire. And then there's the myelin. And the myelin is the insulation around the nerve itself. So you have these two components. And there are different conditions that affect either the axon or the myelin itself. So when we think of the term peripheral neuropathy, it's basically anything, any process that causes damage to these structures in the peripheral nervous system. And it could be anywhere along the course of the nerve. Where we notice the symptoms most is the furthermost area from the spinal cord. So typically, your earliest symptoms will be in your feet, right? Because that's where the longest extension of the nerve. And the nerve also tapers as it extends down. So it's the thinnest portion of a nerve would be down in your feet. So people often have their first symptoms in their feet, whether they be numbness or pain. So when we talk about the causes of peripheral neuropathy, they're typically broken up into big categories: toxic, metabolic, hereditary, and there are infectious causes. The most common causes of peripheral neuropathy in the world, in industrialized nations, are two: alcohol use and diabetes are by far the most common causes. Now, alcohol use doesn't necessarily mean that the person is abusing alcohol. It's just the way some people respond to alcohol, where it is directly toxic to those peripheral nerves. In the case of diabetes, it's really that elevated blood sugar and the way it's metabolized can be deposited inside the nerve, thus causing increased pressure in the nerve and damage to the nerve itself. Other causes, when we think of metabolic causes, thyroid disease, vitamin deficiencies are a big thing. Vitamin B12 deficiency and folic acid deficiency. Now, people with vitamin B12 deficiency, it might not be because of your diet. As we get older, don't forget we absorb vitamin B12 in our stomach, and there's a factor there that helps us absorb it. As we get older, it becomes more difficult to absorb vitamin B12 despite a good diet or despite taking oral vitamins. So again, it's important to check that because some of the early symptoms of that can be a peripheral neuropathy. We also see that problem in people who have had bariatric surgery, right? So when you have had your stomach altered to lose weight, you really need to take supplemental vitamins from that standpoint. Hereditary causes, most commonly is one is Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, which isn't really a disease. It's where the peripheral nerves, when you were born, were different, specifically with respect to the myelin or the axon. People with this often don't notice it, right? Because if you were born with numbness in your feet, you really don't know anything different. So when you see patients with this, they typically have very high arches and hammer toes, which can be seen as a long-term effect of peripheral neuropathy. Other causes, cancer can cause it as well, various types of cancers. Also under the toxic category are chemotherapeutic agents. So a variety of chemotherapies will cause peripheral neuropathy. Interestingly, after you're off the chemotherapy, often the nerves will regenerate. But all of these are taken in the context of an age-related phenomenon. As we get older, our nerves work less efficiently. So next week, we're going to talk a little bit more about diagnosing it, treating peripheral neuropathy, and what it means overall. We're going to take a short break now. We're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Antonel Joy DeMarchida. Dr. DeMarchida is the medical director of the Movement Disorders Center at Hartford Healthcare. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. If you wish to reach out to me, either during the program in this next half hour or during the week, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. It gives me great pleasure to have my guest today being Dr. Joy Antonel DeMarchida. Dr. DeMarchida is the medical director of the David and Rhoda Chase Family Movement Disorder Center at Hartford Healthcare. And she has been a guest on our program before and is a true expert in the field of movement disorders. Tony, welcome back to the show.
My goodness. Thank you very much, Dr. Alessi, for having me again.
So the topic today, I told you we're going to talk a little bit about tremors. And I also want to get into HIFU, or high-intensity focused ultrasound. But can you pave the way and give us some background about what we're talking about when we're talking about tremors and, in general, their types?
I certainly appreciate the opportunity to educate your audience a little bit more about tremor, because tremor is actually very common. It's the most common movement disorder in the world, and there are an estimated 10 million Americans who have it. So tremor is a symptom, right? And it's a symptom of potentially many different conditions. Tremor is that oscillatory rhythmic movement that can occur in the hand, in the head, in the voice, or in the leg. And depending on the nature, the quality, the features of the tremor, then we can determine whether it's caused by one thing or another. There are many different treatment options that are available right now for tremor, depending on which kind it is. And thank you for your interest in hearing more about high-intensity focused ultrasound, because this is certainly the latest technology. We have a lot of excitement at Hartford Healthcare to have been able to be the first in Connecticut, only the fourth in New England, Dr. Alessi, that offers high-intensity focused ultrasound for treatment of tremor in a condition called essential tremor or in Parkinson's disease.
So does everybody get, is there a big portion of tremor that's age-related more than pathologically related?
So there is a, shall we say, a physiologic tremor that can occur actually at any age. And all of us have experienced it, right? We're a little bit nervous or we're hungry and we have a little bit of the shakes. Or if we're exercising and we're particularly fatigued, then we can all exhibit a physiologic tremor. There is also a, I don't like to say it, but a senile tremor, right? A tremor that can occur as people get older, which is said to be benign. But before we assume that a tremor is physiologic or quote-unquote normal for aging, we have to make sure that it isn't a symptom of an underlying neurologic condition such as essential tremor or Parkinson's disease.
You know, Tony, as soon as anybody gets a tremor now and they come into my office, right away their mind goes to Parkinson's disease. When we're looking at tremor in general, what percentage of it is an essential tremor or familial tremor versus a Parkinsonian tremor?
There are 10 times more people who have essential tremor as compared to Parkinson's disease. So as I said earlier, there are 10 million Americans estimated to have essential tremor. There are 1 million Americans who are estimated to have Parkinson's disease. The reason why most people come to the office and more commonly are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease is because a lot of people who have that familial or essential tremor, never come to the doctor's office because they're going to say, oh, yeah, it's the shakes. Everybody in my family has it. Or, yeah, right, it's the same thing that my dad has. And, you know, it doesn't get in the way. So a lot of people with essential tremor, Tony, are never diagnosed and don't ever have to come to the doctor.
You know, sadly, I still remember the days where really the only effective treatment for essential tremor was alcohol. And a lot of famous people, in order to really arrest the tremor, would become alcoholic. I think, you know, that versus a tremor that's related to alcohol withdrawal is important to designate. Can you talk a little bit about the treatments we have now for tremor as opposed to in the past?
So let's talk specifically about essential tremor. And for everybody who's listening out there, what Dr. Alessi is referring to is that this particular kind of tremor, essential tremor, tends to respond to alcohol. But let me say it out loud, let me say it very definitively, that we certainly at this point do not recommend alcohol as a treatment for essential tremor. It's something that we ask about in terms of a matter of interest to help us make a diagnosis. Does your tremor get better when you have a drink? But actually thinking of alcohol as treatment is dangerous, I would say, is not in your best interest because of all of the other adverse effects of alcohol. It's going to fry your nerves. It can cause memory problems. It can cause balance problems. And there are so many issues related to chronic alcohol use. So at this point, we have medications that we can use to actually decrease the symptoms of tremor, treat the tremor, such as propranolol, primidone, topiramate, gabapentin, and there are other interventions that we now recommend to mitigate the symptoms of essential tremor if they are bothersome to you. And the reason why I have that emphasized if is because, as I said earlier, a lot of people will present with essential tremor and never need to come to the doctor because it doesn't get in the way. But at the point that it's actually getting in the way of the things that you love to do, the things that you need to do, then know that we have a lot of treatments to offer in order to try to help diminish the impact of the tremor in your lives.
What are the most common problems people come into you with from tremor? Obviously, you already said the people with essential tremor, some people just feel like they live with it, but when a younger person comes in, what are often the problems they're experiencing?
Depending on their line of work, Tony, then they may feel the impact or the impairment that is associated with their tremor because of what they do for a living. So handwriting is a very obvious thing that people have difficulty with writing. They may have difficulty keyboarding in this day and age. A lot of us don't even write anymore. If they work with their hands, using a screwdriver might become more cumbersome. And in terms of even their daily tasks, when the tremor gets in the way of eating and they carry a glass of water and it's sloshing all over the place, people then become embarrassed to go out. And I hate hearing this, Tony, when people start telling me that they are giving up on their socialization, on going out with their family, because they're embarrassed by the tremor. They don't want to be seen eating in public. That really breaks my heart. And at Hartford Healthcare, that is the reason why we try to bring all of the innovations, all of the possible treatment options in order to help people control their tremor and to try to continue to live their lives as fully as they possibly can despite this neurologic condition.
You know, I think nowhere is it more profound than when we have a patient who's a surgeon or a dentist. where their job requires them to have fine motor control, and they present with tremor, and really they either have to, find effective treatment or stop their profession overall. Those are really the heartbreaking cases. More than any.
Yes, that is very true. Yes, I didn't even consider that as a major disability that will cause a person to end their careers. That is true.
I have a question here from Bob. Bob reports that he had a tremor, saw his doctor, and was put on Inderol, but he couldn't tolerate the Inderol. And unfortunately, he's given up on treatment. Can you talk a little bit specifically? You talked about several different treatments. What's the order of treatment you go in? Do you start with a beta blocker like propranolol, Inderol, and then how do you move through? And I guess one of my questions is, do you still use benzodiazepines for tremor?
Yes. So, Bob, I hope that you will not give up on trying to find treatment for your tremor, because there are other options. Just because you weren't able to tolerate one medication doesn't mean that you're going to have problems with others. As regards your question, Tony, it really depends on the person, and that's the value of how we are as physicians, right? We have to ask for the history. We have to know the other medications that the person is taking. We need to know their medical history. Because depending on all of those factors, then we can choose the appropriate medication or treatment for each individual patient. And that's why we talked about that personalized care, right? Everyone is different. So there isn't really an algorithm by which I go where I say, okay, I start with propranolol first, and then I go to this one next. It really depends on the person's overall history and whether, you know, they may even have other conditions where one medication might treat three different conditions that they have. So, as I mentioned earlier, propranolol is one of the first-line treatments for essential tremor, and so is the medication primidone. Propranolol, as Dr. Alessi mentioned earlier, is a beta blocker. It's usually used to treat high blood pressure and other cardiac conditions, but the main side effect, which may have been something that Bob experienced, is maybe a lightheadedness and fatigue because the blood pressure might be going too low or the pulse rate might be going too low. Primidone, gabapentin, and topiramate were developed as anti-seizure medications, convulsions, a different condition altogether, epilepsy, right? They're anti-epileptic drugs. But what we have found, as we have found in many different situations and for many different medications in medicine, is although a medication is developed for one thing, the mechanism of action of that particular drug may be such that it will help with other conditions that may have the same mechanism of causation. So all of these medications that were used for epilepsy, we found might treat migraine headaches, might treat tremor, might treat leptospike syndrome, because they may have a similar mechanism of action for those different conditions where there's abnormal firing in the brain. There are neurotransmitters that are released that we just have to control.
Do you ever... Do you ever use drugs just symptomatically? I remember that I've had several patients in the past who were like an attorney or someone who would say, listen, the tremor only bothers me if I have to go to a public group or have to be at a dinner, or an attorney who had to be in court. Do you ever just treat them still symptomatically? I would give them a low dose of a benzodiazepine, and it usually would work in the short term. Do you still do that in cases? Because otherwise, in people who are otherwise not bothered by the tremor.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sorry, I didn't address your question earlier about benzo. So benzodiazepines, what Dr. Alessi is referring to, are medications like what people know as Valium and Ativan, Xanax. So these are alprazolam, lorazepam, clonazepam and diazepam, which these are primarily sedatives, right? So a lot of people use it for anxiety and to sleep. But again, it's another one of those medications that we have found also helps with tremor. And they help with tremor not because they are simply relaxing you or treating anxiety, although definitely anxiety can worsen the tremor. But the benzodiazepines, again, the mechanism of action is GABAergic. So it's the mechanism of action of the drug that helps to treat the condition. So yes, Tony, benzodiazepines are still used and particularly effective as needed. The only caveat being that, of course, we don't want to give it to somebody who might get too sleepy after taking the drug and then have to go to court or may have to operate machinery. The other medication that we can use as needed is actually propranolol, Tony. So propranolol given about half an hour before performing on stage, for instance, is a medication that we commonly use for stage fright, for performance anxiety, and can certainly be used just as needed to try to control the trauma.
Let's get right to it. Let's talk a little bit about the latest thing, the HIFU, the high-intensity focused ultrasound. Can you explain what that is to our listeners and what it all means to everyone?
So for people who have refractory essential tremor, or what that means is, you know, their tremor is not responding to medications, and their tremor is still disabling to them and impacting their everyday lives, there are other interventions that we can offer. So the intervention that has been around for many years is deep brain stimulation surgery. That's like a pacemaker, but instead of putting the pacemaker in the heart, you put a pacemaker in the brain. It's very effective in treating the symptoms of essential tremor. However, it is brain surgery. So the reason for our excitement and the reason why we are so proud to be able to offer HIFU is because as compared, in contrast to deep brain stimulation surgery, HIFU is an incisionless procedure. So what that means is that it doesn't involve the surgeon going into your brain to put in a pacemaker or to create a lesion. It is just the use of ultrasonic signals, which they send right through the skull in order to create a lesion in the part of the brain called the thalamus that can completely ameliorate or eliminate the tremor. It's actually, we've done a few of them since we launched in August of 2024, and the results are just, it's just so gratifying, so miraculous, so amazing, that it truly is a life-altering intervention that we can offer that is incisionless. So it's the ability to achieve the results that we can see with deep brain stimulation surgery without the surgery per se. So no anesthesia. However, a big if is that HIFU is performed with such precision that at the point that the neurosurgeon is sending those ultrasonic signals precisely into the target in the brain that he needs to create the lesion in, the person has to be inside an MRI machine. So that's something that I always need to remember to mention to people. So if people are unable to go into an MRI machine, then HIFU may not be for them, such as if they are claustrophobic or if they do have a pacemaker that precludes the use of the MRI, then they may not be eligible for HIFU. But otherwise, this is a treatment that can be done for people who may not be a candidate for surgery because they have other medical conditions or who are older. We have treated people who are more than 80 years old because it is so well tolerated and safe.
So when after the treatment, I mean, I've seen some of the videos and some of the results. How long does it last for, the treatment? Is it permanent? Do they have to do this periodically?
It's one and done, Tony. And the clinical trial, so it was approved for treatment of essential tremor in 2016. So we now have five-year data in the medical literature, and it has shown persistence of benefit. So the improvement in the tremor that was seen immediately after the procedure, because right there and then you see the tremor stop, that was sustained over 5 years in the clinical trials. So yeah, there are some people who can have a recurrence of tremor, and in these particular situations, then it can be repeated later on. And there are some people who progress with their tremor over time, and at that point, then it can be repeated. But in terms of just what is the durability of the effect of that procedure, it is established to be persistent over 5 years at this point.
Complications?
As with all lesioning surgeries, or lesioning procedures, key is targeting. So you want to try to put it in the exact place of the brain where you're going to control the tremor without causing complications. However, if there is a lesion that touches another part of the brain, say the internal capsule or a different part of the thalamus, then people can have numbness or tingling around their mouth or in their hand. Some people may have balance difficulties, slurred speech. A lot of the complications of HIFU have been shown to be transient. So within 3 months and certainly within 6 months, most of these complications have resolved. And for some people, even within days, the complications have resolved.
Wow. Tony, thank you. Thank you for this information and making this available. If you're listening to this program and you want to reach out to Dr. DeMarchida, the phone number is 860-870-6385, and that is for the Chase Family Movement Disorder Center. Tony, thanks again for coming on and making this available to our patients.
Very much for the opportunity, and be safe, everyone, this evening.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to our studio producer. Joey Burgoyne's been on the board today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you want to get the Healthy Rounds podcast and listen to today's program, just go to Audacy.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.